So welcome. How's the volume for? So that's good. Everybody can hear okay? So welcome to this Tuesday evening. If you don't know me, my name is Tim Guile. I'm one of the local Dharma leaders. And so Ronnie asked me to cover this class. So tonight I'd like to talk about spiritual sincerity. Okay, as a topic that I think has a lot of pertinence for us as lay practitioners, as you know, with making our spiritual lives, our daily lives, to not have those separate. So spiritual sincerity can come from, actually from the very fabric of our lives. We can use the texture of our lives, the details of our lives, to create that sincerity. And that sincerity can give us the fuel, the energy to really investigate deeply this friction we often have with life. And then from that friction, we can make this life, this very life, a spiritual path. So spiritual sincerity can have many different forms and different manifestations, but it often has as a root a sense of urgency in relationship to reflecting on our death, that our lives won't live past, we won't live forever, that our lives will eventually end. And that can bring a sense of urgency to it. Henry David Thoreau put it this way, that I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what they had to teach, and not, when it came time to die, to discover that I had not lived. So many of us come to spiritual practice with a similar intention. We have this similar desire to live deliberately, to live consciously, to use this precious life well, to take advantage of it to its fullest. So for Thoreau, this meant going into the woods, to leaving his normal life, the stream of how his life was going, to have a conscious decision to go to a simpler time, to a simpler structure of his life, so he can really deepen into what he felt was most pertinent for us, for him. So each of us has to find the sense of urgency in our own lives. What brings us that urgency of a light, a fire? And to see what practice deepens, allows us to use that urgency to its best result. For some of us, that means going to leaving this environment of our lives, to going to the monastery, to becoming a monk or a nun, or going on extended retreats, to leaving the environment of our life and really having a whole different situation that really supports our practice. But for others, for many of us in this room, and myself included, we use our life itself as a spiritual practice. So this requires a lot of sincerity, a lot of commitment and urgency for that to work, because we lack the structure of a retreat. We don't have the rules of conduct. We don't have the constant, all we have to do is worry about meditating, no responsibilities. With our lives, we have families, we have jobs, we have things we have to do. And so for that, this practice to work as a fully equal practice to becoming a monk or a nun, we need to have this deep sincerity and deep urgency in our practice for that to come root. Because we realize that if we don't treat each moment with a great deal of seriousness, of a great deal of care, we can easily find at the end of our lives that we haven't lived fully, that we haven't fully lived this life. So we go on retreats, we listen to talks, read books, you know, we meet with like-minded people like in this Sangha, and we find it moves us in a deep way. But yet when we go back to our daily lives, we find a lot of distractions, the pulls of responsibility, of making a living, you know, the allure of gaining, of possessions, the need to struggle with life, to fix things, to overcome difficulty. And so often our spiritual practice can be forgotten, or at least temporarily put on the side. So other things start to seem more important, the things that we're gaining, both materially and also our experiences, our relationships, things that we really want to help fulfill our lives. So I'd like to share a story from the suttas. And so this is from about a being who got distracted, as we often do. Now this story does have some mythology in it. It has some supernatural powers and some gods. So don't get distracted by whether that's true or not, but focus on the underlying message, how it pertains to our lives. Focus on this message. So it's the story of a being named Sankara, who is a ruler of the gods. So he came down one day to listen to the Buddha, to ask him a very pertinent question. What do you mean by the destruction of craving? And how does that lead to liberation? How does that work? So the Buddha told him, and he says, thank you, and then he went back, vanished back up to the heavenly realms. Okay? So one of the Buddha's chief disciples, Magallana, was wondering if that really sunk in, what the Buddha had said. Did that really sink into what had been said deeply? So he decided to follow him up because he was able to transport himself up into these heavenly realms too, apparently. So he went in and visited this god, this king of the gods, and he asked, well, what did the Buddha tell you? How did that sit with you? Was that meaningful for you? And he said, well, you know, we're really busy up here. There's just a lot of stuff to do. I've got my business. I've got all these other gods to take care of. We just had this war with the Titans, and we want it. And plus, we've made this huge palace. It's got 100 towers with 700 floors in each tower. Every pleasure imaginable you can have right away. You'd like to visit it? You know, so he was, and I kind of forgot what the Buddha said, to be honest. So this monk went along with them to see this palace, this incredible palace. And he was just getting a sense that the teachings of the Buddha did not take root. They just washed over us, over him. And notice in your own lives, how often do you get caught up in the allure of life? I mean, if you look at the internet, how long does it take you to have something more interesting to look at? You can just spend hours following one sense pleasure to another, this story to this story. You can go into a grocery store and have, you know, an endless supply of tastes, sweets, you know, savory, whatever you desire, you know, movies. It's all so available to us. So in some ways we live our lives like these diva realms. So we have all these pleasures. So this monk, caring for the well-being of this ruler, this king, tapped the palace and made the whole thing tremble and shake. Okay, so this is a palace they took as being really solid and also lasting forever. I mean, the gods in these realms have such long lifespans, it seems like they would never die. And so the buildings they build have the same kind of projection of permanence. And so to have this whole structure shake really woke up everyone. It really was like a sobering moment to realize what they held as being so solid wasn't. And so as the sutta goes, the king had his hair stood on end with his sincerity, with his urgency to practice. And he recalled what the Buddha said and then had a great energy to apply it, to bring it forth. So in our own lives, how often does this story play out? We hear the Dharma and then we get distracted by life. We get caught up in what we have to do and the urgency of that, the allure of the pleasures that the world offers us. But at the same time, we also have these shakings that happen. They're happening all the time on a subtle level. If you pay attention, just how do you expect the weather to be? How do you expect what's the next person's going to say? This projection of continuity is always being shaken if we pay attention. And of course, there's the big shakes of life, the shakes of death, of loss, of aging, that can shake us very, very dramatically and really catch our attention. So this kind of shaking can be used as a spiritual sincerity to nurture that in a very, very simple and direct way. Now often when we reflect on the fact that we will age, that we'll become sick, that we will die, it can have a sense of, we can feel a lot of upsetness around this, anxiety around that, my life will end. A lot of fear and tension, almost paralysis can come forth from that reflection. Now the Buddha, actually, before he came the Buddha, he was reflecting that okay, I'm going to get old, I'm going to get sick, I'm going to eventually die. Those are the facts of life. And does it make any sense to be shocked by those, to be paralyzed by those? So obviously he had gone through his own shock of those. But you realize that the best use of that to align with that reality of life, that this is how the way things are. So if we can align with that, then we can use that as a sense of deep urgency in our practice. So the Buddha in the Anaguttara Nikaya, so the numerical discourses, he laid out five reflections, or five themes for reflection that can help us with this sense of urgency. And he preferenced these reflections. They're good for anyone, for a woman or a man or a monk or a layperson, a nun or a layperson. He held this as such a vital part of a practice, no matter where we are within life, whether we've gone forth or using a household or life. So these reflections help us to lose the trance of our normal life, how we get lost in the details of how we want things to be. So use them to create a sense of sincerity. They're not designed to shock you or to make you depressed, but to bring a sense of liveliness to your practice. So these reflections, I put them back by the Dhamma basket. And you can see them, if you like, as a daily practice. Before you meditate, it can be very nice. Before you go to bed or when you wake up. And just allow them to slowly sink in. You know, just slowly see them and let the fact of these reflections sink into your consciousness a little bit. And to see how your actions of mind, how you think, how you relate to yourself mentally and others, how your actions of speech and of body relate, how do they change based on how these reflections are held. So as we listen tonight, I'll go through these reflections with us tonight. As you listen, let them in. You know, see if you can soften around them. There might be initial resistance and pushing back. And I think of it kind of like a house plant that's been neglected. Okay, it's very dry, and the root wad is not very receptive to water. So if you pour a lot of water in it, it's going to flood, and you're going to spill out over your bookshelf. So instead, add just a little bit of water at a time so that the soil can start to expand and use the water to its best result. The same too with these reflections, to not flood your mind with, okay, I'm going to die, I'm going to lose everything, but just to gradually let your mind accommodate to that. So the first one is, I am subject to aging. I'm not beyond aging. So this confronts this infatuation we have in society with the youth, with vigor, with power, with beauty. That we hold these up, we value everything by how youthful it is. In some ways, it's really one of the gods that we worship in this culture, the god and goddess of youth. What's the saying that the 50s is the new 30s? You know, there's these whole businesses, whole economic sectors, which is designed to help promote this denial of this truth, that we age, that you too can be young forever, that you don't have to worry about becoming old. Okay, so this is pushing away of this reality. So the way I like to work with this practice myself is as I walk through the world and I see someone who's older than me, especially someone that triggers a sense of, you know, perhaps unease or disgust, or, you know, there's a reactivity that comes up. Perhaps they're very decrepit, not very able to move very well, or they're moving slowly. And just to reflect that, just as I am, they were. And just how they are, I may be. Just to let that reality sink in a little bit, that I won't be young forever, that I won't have this youth and this power forever. And as we hold that, we don't want to disregard our aging bodies. We have a sense of care for them, a sense of taking what needs to be done to help support that. But at the same time, not having our happiness dependent on being young, being youthful. So the next reflection is, I am subject to illness. I'm not beyond illness. So next time you're sick, just notice how that the mind reacts against that, rebels against that reality of how this body is feeling, wants to push it away, wants to deny it. I mean, often we feel like we're a failure if we become sick. You know, somehow if I was really on top of things, I would never a cold again. I would never be sick again. And hear the denial of this basic fact. So how much do we add to the reality of being sick? How much do we add of a sense of tension around that? Can we add as little as possible? This is very difficult when we do have illness, especially severe illness or chronic illness. Last year I had a kidney stone, and it was certainly the most severe pain that I had. Okay, so I was able to accommodate it somewhat meditatively and relax with it until the next time it came. You know, it gave me a couple months respite, and then it started again. And then there was this, it was actually, the pain was manageable. It was the fear of the pain coming back and what that would mean, that the days and days of being incapacitated based on the past history. All this was added to this moment of discomfort, of illness. As a friend of mine says, who has chronic pain, what really helped him is to learn how to divorce the fear from the pain. But usually when they come together, it becomes very unmanageable. But it is difficult. It takes a while to accommodate, to work with that. And so even though there's this reflection that I am subject to illness, I'm not beyond illness, we still care for our bodies. We still have prevention. But just as we become sick, as we inevitably will, to not hold our happiness dependent on the health. So the third reflection is that I am subject to death. I'm not beyond death. So often we live like our lives will go on forever. We have plenty of time to indulge in the world of craving, of getting more and more possessions, more experiences, whether they're material or meditative even. That we'll always have time. Later on I can get serious about my spiritual practice. I can really, there'll be time, you know, later on. But please don't wait. And there's no guarantees of how long you will be here, how long life will be. Often when people are on their last months of life, when they know that they have a terminal diagnosis, their priorities are very much transformed. How they relate to themselves and others, the simplicity of life, the simple beauties like a flower, you know, a smile, connecting with someone, those become very important to them. And so often we forget that, we push that away. So this is an invitation, this reflection gives us an invitation to live deliberately, to at the end of our lives to realize we have lived, that we have fully lived. It gives us a chance to do that. And it's not just at the end of our lives. We can also approach it moment by moment. How is this moment giving birth, and how is this moment ending? How is the death of this moment? Have I lived deliberately for this moment as well as for my whole life? So the fourth reflection is I will grow different, separate from all that is dear and appealing to me. So this point of all these reflections isn't to devastate you, to throw you into depression or into shock or into tension, but actually to learn to have a deep appreciation for life, to really open to the beauty and wonder and joy of life, the pleasures of life, but to hold it lightly, not to grasp it. It's like if we were holding our hand out and a butterfly landed. We try to hold it to keep it longer, we would crush it. And just allow it to come, and then as it naturally flies away, to have a sense of open-heartedness around that, a graciousness that now this experience has passed, whether it's this moment or this life. So we're learning how, through this reflection, to align ourselves with this fact of life instead of living in denial of it, of trying to push this fact away. So last year, I had a couple lessons around this reflection. So I have an acquaintance who went to bed one night, and then during the night she died. She passed away in her sleep, completely unexpected. And so her relatives, her sisters, had to come and help take care of her effects. And so it was interesting to come into that room, her apartment, and just see all her belongings, all her cherished belongings and things that she lived with, that suddenly they no longer were hers. They were just dispersed. And so as I go through my house and I see things that I particularly like, I often reflect on that woman. And just I too, everything I own, everything I hold dear, will be taken away, will eventually have to be let go of. So including our relationships, including our mind states, including this sense of who we are, who we take ourselves to be. The other lesson came from a neighbor who passed away, and his house was in disrepair. So when he died, they decided to tear it down. And so one day I walked by his house, and then later that day it was a big pile of rubble. And the wrecking ball came and tore it down. And so often when I look at my house and I do house projects, just to hold things a little lighter, just realize that someday this too, this house, this thing I hold so dear, will become a pile of rubble. To hold that lightly. Not to deny the enjoyment of it, to take care of things, but just also to realize that eventually it will disappear. Eventually it will no longer be yours. How much does our happiness depend on our possessions, including our thoughts, our ideas, our concepts? Because we hold those very, very dear. So moment by moment, how do we allow the aging of this moment, the illness of this moment, the death of this moment? So the fifth reflection is, I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions. So this one we can look at in terms of how we relate to each moment's experience, reconditions how that experience will come forth in the future. So if we meet life, we have an argument with someone, we add more argument to that, we fight more with that, the next time that situation comes forth, we're likely to go back into the argument. There's a momentum that comes forth. If we have a friction and a resistance to life, then that will most naturally have a momentum to come forth again. The same too, if we release a resistance, release our control around life, then the next time that it comes forth, that may come forth more. So each moment, are we living deliberately, or are we waiting for a better moment to come? And how is this moment being met? And that starts to create a momentum, both for being unconscious, being in denial of life, or being more and more conscious. So these reflections, these five reflections, can create a lot of sincerity, a lot of urgency to our practice. So how do we best use that? How do we use it in a way that's helpful? The main point is, how do we invest in this moment? Do we invest in our struggle, in our fight with life, or in the release of that struggle? Because the chief way that we don't live fully is through argument with life, with this moment's expression. We want this moment to be different, either a little longer, a little bit better, more interesting. It's not to deny that we have plans, that we work toward things, that we try to have our life better, but just moment by moment, as we're trying to go along our lives, how do we relate to that? There's three main ways that we argue with reality. We argue with life. So one is not wanting it, pushing it away. This is unacceptable. I don't like this feeling in my body. I don't like this state of my mind. I don't like this person in front of me. I don't like the traffic or the weather. So there's a sense of pushing away, a sense of anger, of hatred, fear often. There's also the way we deny life or resist life is through wanting. So often this moment will be much better when this happens. When I finally get this experience, when I get this relationship, when the weather changes, when it rains, when it gets sunny. So there's a sense of longing. And even if the moment is wonderful, often is that held with a sense of grace? Or is it a sense of wanting it to always continue? Can I have that moment again? Can I come back again? So you can feel the tightness of denying the fact that things will change. And the third way is that we find life boring at times, uninteresting. Just there's nothing that really catches our interest, that catches our heart. So we check out. We wish only that something would happen finally. And this is also a friction with life. So usually we're so busy trying to overcome this friction, trying to get more of something, to orchestrate life in a certain way, to get rid of things we don't like, to make life more interesting. We're always kind of in this frenetic way that we don't realize that it's unconsciously being driven by this friction. But the friction happens and quickly we're acting to trying to fix it, trying to get rid of it. We're not living deliberately, as Thoreau would say, or consciously. But who wins the argument in the end? Okay, who wins it when we finally become older, when we become ill, when we die? So And when we hold those reflections, we start to realize maybe this argument with reality doesn't make much sense. To invest, keep investing in it, keep adding to that momentum of that argument. So often what happens is, like, let's say, give an example, if someone says something to you and you have this feeling of being hurt, being misunderstood, feeling mad about it. And usually what we do, our normal way of acting, is to start to elaborate on that. Well, how could they say that about me? They're so wrong and I am so right. Okay, I'm going to call my friend, I'm going to tell them about this outrage that this person has said. And I'm going to write a letter, I'm going to send an email, I just can't believe it. And so there's this whole investment upon investment of action of mind, action of voice, and hopefully not action of body, but sometimes it goes that way. And we act out, we hurt someone. So it says, taking the sense of friction, someone says something that hurt us, and we're adding more and more weight to how we, to the validity of that friction. We're adding more and more momentum to that friction. And so in the future, that friction will have a lot of purchase when it comes up. So really we're choosing to enforce this conditioning of suffering, the conditioning of friction, of argument with life. We're signing up for future suffering. Now there's a lot of momentum behind this pattern, as we've probably noticed, that it's easy to have a prick of discomfort, of pain. We automatically want to act on it. We want to fix it. So these five reflections can help give us some footing with that. To kind of, next time we're having a, like with my wife, you know, she might say something and I feel this sense of wanting to control it or do something different. So lately I've been asking, well, is this the end of the world if it doesn't go my way? Does it really matter that my control be manifested in this moment? And so we both have a greater sense of happiness around that. Greater sense of peace. So this is, I'm talking right now about this withdrawing of the energy toward the argument with life. But that alone isn't enough. Because if we just do the withdrawing of the energy, we're doing an act of will often, a sense of tension. We start to apply friction with more subtle friction, an argument with more of a Dharma argument. Okay? And we're still caught in this whole pattern. So investigation allows us to start to go down deeper to these places that we get held, that we get identified. So what I mean by investigation? Okay. So when we start to learn to meditate, we learn how to focus on our breath. We can tune in to focus on just the in-breath or just the out-breath, focus in on our left foot or our right hand, and have this sense of directing where our attention is. So investigation has this quality of directing where our attention goes. But it's also balanced with awareness, with a sense of loosening our need to be identified with it, to be a sense of I'm controlling where it's going. So there's more and more a sense of allowing the awareness to see. It directs to look in this area, and then it steps back. We step out of the picture. So we can use investigation to look at the sense of friction with our lives. A sense of wanting things to be different, a sense of argument with how things are. So often we first notice it when there's an emotional triggering, you know, anger, sadness, fear, joy, or there's this also a sense of I am this, or you are that, when we're really weighing in strongly on an idea, not an opinion. Okay, those are all invitations to investigate, to really look a little deeper. So as we start to look at this, we want to have a quality of non-judgmental investigation. So we set aside our preferences, our evaluation of what is good and what is bad. What's more important is to see clearly. Okay, so we interrupt the pattern of adding to our argument, but not judging ourselves because the argument came forth. As we investigate, I think it's helpful to think of it as a 5-to-1 ratio. Okay? So 5 parts body sensation, 1 part thought, 1 part thinking. Okay, so as we're investigating, let's say, some slight or some irritation, some place where we're held, or something we're really desiring, something we're wanting, we feel it in our bodies, feel the sensations of that. Where is it located in our bodies? And there's a slight awareness of what the thought, the story is. Okay? Now the story, this is where it gets tricky, because the story can become very alluring. It can take us away into the details, into the argument very easily. It's like if you're watching a movie and telling a friend about it, instead of telling about all the actors and the details of what happened, you break it down to a very basic plot. Boy meets girl. Okay? So instead of, you know, my wife said this to me and I'm mad about this, it's like, okay, there's a sense of being hurt, of being not understood. And so we stabilize at this level and we just be with it, we study with it, and it starts to drop as we go through. So a great deal of compassion is needed, because this type of investigation will lead us to places of tenderness in ourselves, places of hurt, often from early years and childhood years. Our parents treated us a certain way, or different experiences happened a certain way that caused a constriction, caused a belief structure to start to come forth. And it has a strong driving in our lives. So we have this sense of tenderness, a sense of compassion as we connect with this deeper layers of pain. It also requires a tremendous sincerity of practice to do this. Because we really don't want to investigate our pain. We want to push it away. I was giving a talk to a high school group a couple weeks ago, and one student, I was asking them to connect with the sensations of pain felt in their body, emotional pain. And he said that, "My mind is just rebelling at that suggestion." He says, "I do not want to do that." And just the sincerity of how he expressed that. And we have such a desire to push away, to hide from what's discomfort, has a discomfort in our emotions, in our minds. And we want to go to the allure of the details of the story of what we need to talk about, how we can fix it. So ways that we start to avoid seeing deeper is often rationalization. Like, I'm through with that, I'm beyond that. Carrie talked about this a few weeks ago, the quality of the nonviolent communication, that often they're asked to connect with that deeper sense of what's motivating their speech, the deeper pain that's motivating it. And how often meditators of experience will say, "Well, I'm kind of beyond that. That's all empty. I don't have to really connect with that. Why connect with that?" So that's a rationalization that they've insulated from this deeper pain, the spiritual bypassing. We can also avoid feeling it through infatuation, through actually feeling it so deeply that we get lost in the intensity of it without having a sense of going deeper. We get lost in the more superficial rage or sadness or fear without listening deeper, the deeper currents of emotion. Now, as we go through this investigation, it's helpful to have a certain broadness of our investigation, to not only have the sense of story, what's the soft story we're trying to track, but also the sensations in the body, and also the sense of emotionality. So having these all three help us stay more honest. Because we can rationalize, we can have a sense of, okay, I know how this is, but our heart has a tension, or our body has a tension. So really taking your time as you go through investigation. So two questions I'd like to offer for this type of investigating this argument of life, with life. First one is, what do I get out of this friction with life? What do I get out of this argument? What is the payoff that I keep investing into this argument? Because there has to be some benefit, otherwise we would just let it drop. So we get to feel righteous, we get to feel powerful, I have an opinion, sometimes I get to feel pitiful. There's a familiarity to that, to feeling that sense of being the poor me, a sense of comfort in that in a strange way. And ultimately we get to be I. We get to have a sense of me that has this emotion, that has this belief. The second question is, what is the pain that's driving this friction? So this is really the movement from the superficial to the deep. So first we connect with a general label, like perhaps I feel upset that this person didn't listen to me. There's a sense of being unheard. And as I start to quiet down, I go deeper and see there's a sense of not being worthy, not being important. You know, feeling the emotions and body sensations as we do that. So eventually we start to work down to the deeper and deeper layers. It's like we're walking down through these strata. We take our time and can really connect with everything in this one strata, and then we drop down. And this is, it's like going into the woods and sitting quietly and listening, looking for wildlife to come out of the foliage. If you start to push through the bushes and make a lot of noise, everything will fly away. But if we're just still and quiet, then things start to show themselves. And so too with this type of investigation, we start to see, oh, this sense of being righteous and being angry is actually a sense of inadequacy, a sense of lack, a deep sense of core lack. As we start to hold that and feel that and investigate that, we start to realize that this lack can't be filled by anything. No matter how many people give me appreciation, give me love, the logic is that will fix it, right? If I can get this one person to say, I love you, or I care about you, that you're important, then somehow that deep lack will vanish. And that's the logic, the faulty logic of this pattern that drives us. So you start to see how that deep pattern becomes this foundation of how many of our behaviors act out, how we act out in our business realm, in our romantic realms, whatever it might be. It's based on this deep sense of lack. And so as we connect with that very slowly and quietly and tenderly, we start to see, well, how can this lack be filled by any action of mind, body, or speech? You know, it's something that's so deep. And we start to realize that it's like a kaleidoscope. You know, we're looking through the world with a certain setting in the kaleidoscope, and everything looks this way. It makes sense through the kaleidoscope, how we are in the world, how everyone else in the world. And we often try to just change the setting in the kaleidoscope. Okay, I'm going to change from self-hatred to self-love. Okay, but we're just still looking through this kaleidoscope. So if this investigation can take you to a place where you realize that you can't just change that, you have to set aside the kaleidoscope. There's only that, the only thing that's left is this deep surrendering into stillness, really releasing the sense of friction, the sense of argument with life in a deep, profound way. So we, instead of trying to change life to fit us, we accommodate life, accommodate this moment's experience. Shantideva said it this way, that we're not here to change the world is here to change us. So to fully live, to fully come to the end of our lives and have the sense of, yeah, this life was well lived, we have to give up what is most dear to us. Okay? Not talking about our possessions, our relationships, our sense of identity. Time will take care of all of those. But our very friction with life is what we hold dear, the very argument with life. Because in that argument, we were able to arise, the sense of I is able to arise. When we release the argument, when we release the friction, the sense of I fades into just another phenomenon. It loses its pertinence, loses its significance. So in releasing this argument, we release the self. We release our separation. And only sincerity can do this. And in that release, we also release our suffering. So can we sit for a moment or two? As we sit, I'd like to read a poem by Mary Oliver called When Death Comes. When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps his purse shut. When death comes, like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending as all music does, towards silence. And each body a line of courage, and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was a bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. So we have a chance for any questions or comments, you know, both about the talk and also just about your general practice is fine at this time. Yes?
So my life path has to do with people during the last generation of their life, and so I feel like I'm pretty connected to spiritual sincerity.
Yes. Sure. So the question is, this woman works with people at the end of their lives, and so she finds there's a lot of sincerity that comes forth from that. There's a huge amount of spiritual sincerity. And the question is whether that can be over too much. Can you be flooding the houseplant with too much sincerity? Does it become something other than that? Does that cover the question? Okay. Well, in this talk, I try to guide us through this spectrum of, at first there's a sense of denial of this basic fact of life, that we will die. Okay? And so in your case, you have this fact is always in your face, that you see it. Okay, every person I work with, this person's near the end of their life. So it's a very real fact to you, and that's one of the benefits of working with hospice, or working with people at the end of their lives, that brings that sense of urgency. But you're absolutely right that at some point we can have a sense of pushing too much, of trying to accomplish something, that I have to get someplace. That the urgency can have this expression of trying to, if I can just get enlightened, or if I can just get liberated, or if I can just do this or that, then I'll be using my life well. So we need a certain amount of that, you know, initially. But as our practice matures, we start to see that eventually we have the only thing that makes sense. It's not to try to orchestrate or deal with the friction of life or even try to investigate it deeply, but simply to finally release that friction, to release the need to fight with this moment's experience. And so in that case, the power of will doesn't make sense anymore. And so it's kind of, we all have to go through this spectrum of applying our will, having a lot of urgency. This is really vital for me, to get some purchase in our practice. But eventually there's a sense of, okay, there's nothing that needs to be done. We can't skip to the end and say, okay, there's nothing needs to be done, I can just coast and take it easy. Because, you know, we can, you know, obviously hide a lot of deep pills of our life. So just soften your practice a little bit. Just start to notice, become more subtle with it. Instead of having this sense of, I have to do this, just say, okay, become curious about where you start to feel the friction of life. How subtle can that be? Because it can be, as you know, it can be very gross or very obvious. I'm mad at this person, to just the sense of a watcher with meditation, a sense of there's someone knowing what's being felt, what's being seen. So eventually that falls away, so there's just a stillness, there's a way that awareness holds experience and holds the details of life as easily too. Does that help? You're welcome. Yes.
Would you repeat the two questions? One was, what's the benefit of some feeling or feeling tone? You know, why you go into it and sort of elaborate it? And what was the second question?
Okay, so the question is, what are the two questions
yes.
of investigation? So the first one is, as you said, to investigate what is the payoff of this behavior. What am I getting out of it? And that's, I'll get to your second question in a second, but that's an important piece because if we don't look at what the payoff is, there's something that's always been hidden. We think, okay, why would I want to suffer? You know, why would I want to be angry? That makes no sense. But that's not a very sincere way of looking at it. You say, well, really, what is it the benefit of being angry? What's the benefit of suffering? What's the benefit of having this friction with life? And ask that in a deepening, it's not like you ask the question and I got the answer and I can go home. It's like it just deepens over time. You start to realize that this sense of friction is very much tied with how I am, the sense of self in a very deep way. We have to walk our way through that. And each one of us in this room has a particular psychic makeup based on our history, based on our experiences, our memories, that it's actually the perfect spiritual practice. I mean, you're carrying your perfect spiritual practice with you. I mean, it's custom made for you. Isn't that great, you know? Okay, so that's the first question is, you know, what is the benefit? What is the payoff? Asking that really sincerely. The second question is, what pain is driving this? Okay, because there's also a deep sense of, what I mean by pain, it's often a sense of a conglomerate of self-belief. Like for myself, it often comes down to inadequacy, self-lack, some insufficiency. There's something fundamentally wrong with me. Okay, so I'm saying it very simply and easily, but you know, there's a lot of depth that went down to feel that, to connect with that. But there's also the emotional believing in that, how that the body takes that as real. And then there's also all the behaviors of how I act, react to people, react to situations. You can often trace it down. A moment of friction here is related to this sense of deep lack. This moment of friction here is related to the same lack.
I'll tell you what triggered it is that I was really irritated during your meditation by the late comers to more than usual. And so then I spend most of my meditation having to work with that.
Yes.
And so now when you gave the talk, I was reflecting again on, okay, so what was the benefit to me of feeling that way? None, I have no control over it. It's just some noise. You know, I tried to like think, it's nothing. But then what's the deeper pain? You know, what's the, you know, upsetting to my ego, sense of control, or it's not the way I used to do it before, you know, we didn't let it happen that way. It was all this little event, you know. It's like, whoop. So your lecture really sort of like kind of got encapsulated in that sense tonight of tonight's particular circumstances for me.
So just to summarize it for the recording, that latecomers during the sit had created a sense of irritation, frustration, and there's a lot of ruminating over or dealing with it during the sitting, and how the talk seemed to talk to that. And that's actually, I mean, it's a very helpful way to use our lives. We have a sense of friction. Okay, the example of someone coming in late, the sense of irritation. So usually we think about it, we try to, like, you know, like you said, why didn't they do it differently? That's all elaborating, investing into the friction. So instead we say, okay, what's the initial feeling? They shouldn't do this. They're not respecting the silence or whatever it might be. But then you broaden out a little bit. Say, how do I feel that in my body? You be still with it. Be quiet with it. And then it starts to drop. Oh, you know, maybe I'm not being respected. And you drop a little bit more. And you can get to the kernel of things, and often the irritation then falls away.
It did finally. Although, I swore your meditation was an hour.
Well,
that struggle.
You know, last time I led a meditation, my watch died halfway through it. So it was like 7:10. I was like, oh, wow, this is great. You know, we've just... And it was actually 7:25, so luckily I noticed that clock. But we did about a 45 minute. All right, what other questions are there or comments about meditation length or otherwise? You're welcome. So the comment was on gratitude for making you look at things you don't like to look at. But also just realizing that we often can look at Dharma talks and Dharma books and really online things and find a certain comfort with that. That it's comfortable to read about the Dharma. But it's very different to take it on to ourselves. And so a simple practice like these five reflections, it brings a different, because ultimately you have to make it your own, right? And so teachers, talks, books, it's all pointing you in a direction that may be helpful to look. But you have to find that way for yourself. And the great thing about these reflections is it creates this energy of sincerity that you can take it wherever you need to take it. And you might explore something very different than I talked about. And you can find the pertinence for yourself. Because the way we really fight with life is in contradiction to these five reflections. That ultimately the struggle of life denies that those reflections are true. What else? Yes.
My only possessions are my actions, or my only possessions are my deeds. And that puts a little bit different spin on it, and it becomes, sort of adds an element of karma, and also struggle with that friction of owning.
Yes.
Clutching. So I just wanted to share that.
So the comment is on the fifth reflection, she has a translation that she's used to using, which is... my only possession is my actions. Yeah, and so that's a nice one. Yeah, this last one, there's action is also translated as karma. And see, I didn't use karma intentionally because karma has all this baggage about, you know, good and bad, heaven and hell, punishment and salvation that we can carry, we can project on it. But think of action, of karma, as simply being, and that's actually how the Buddha translated, karma is action, volitional action. It's intentional action. That's something I'm choosing to do. Okay, so that's, It's how we make our choices, whether it's very simple like the precepts, you know, if we're deciding to steal and hurt people, lie, all those things will have a certain momentum to how things will come forth. And same thing if we follow the precepts. So it's actually a very... I used to rebel a lot about karma, but it's become a very pertinent thing in the sense of how my volitional actions set the stage for how things will unfold in the future. Yes.
You know, as I get older, the aging thing is quite obvious, and the illness thing.
Yes.
The death thing, I haven't died yet, so and I haven't come close to dying either. So that there's still I can still be pretty abstracted.
Yes.
You know, I think your ones would die and so forth. So what I really like about the looking at every moment and the friction of every moment, it's because that's every moment.
Yes.
And, you know, and it's right here and it's right now. And, you know, unless you want to just close your eyes, you can't not deal with that.
Yes. Yes, so the comment was about as this woman ages, and aging is very prominent, you know, it's concrete. Illness is concrete, but death is not concrete because it's you haven't died yet. And so there's a sense of abstraction around it. But yet talking about it in terms of this moment-by-moment friction, it brings this something you can't deny. There's an accessibility to it. So with death, just as you were saying, you can look at the death of this moment. You know, the death is just the ending of time. The ending of tomorrow's. Okay. Now, before, don't freak out. Don't have, you know, because there's this sense of that comes up. I got these things I need to do. I need to say goodbye. You know, just suspend that for a moment. But just where is tomorrow, other than in our minds? Where is the next moment, other than in our minds? So you can see that death is actually something. It's another. You can also talk about it as being the stillness. Is simply the releasing of the projection on the future. The future moment will be this way, or I hope it to be this way, or not this way. It's just a simple releasing of that. So it actually can be a very safe place to connect with. Yeah, through this moment by moment relationship to it. Thank you. I'm always nervous asking a question in a group. So give a little space for the nervous ones like me to raise your hand. Yes.
So when talking about urgency, you mentioned, and I think Mary Oliver mentioned in her poem, about getting to the end and not having lived life, or not having or been a visitor.
Right, yes.
And the sense of, like, you know, do this, don't put this off, because you don't know how long you have. That idea seems to, in my experience, imply that the goal of the practice is to reach kind of a state as quickly as you can and then accumulate, you know, enlightenment points because you're living your life in an enlightened way. But, you know, when we think about that, obviously that seems kind of
silly.
So I guess I'm curious if you could expand on that idea of why is it important to get there as fast as we can, wherever there is. Even that idea I don't really understand. And how can you look at urgency without the idea of limited time?
Okay, so the question was around that often urgency or spiritual sincerity has this quality of there's not much time, so you have to really get your act together. And there can be a sense of feeling like you have to accumulate all these Dharma points so you can get your enlightenment badge, and you know, so you're trying to obtain something. So there's a sense of having it. And how does that? What was the second part of your question? It was about how does that? Let me speak around that and see if I hit your other question there. So the point of the urgency isn't to try to accumulate or to do a lot of things, and that's the one thing that's a little. I was thinking about naming this talk "Sincerity or Spiritual Urgency," but I decided not to because of that reason. That it can have a sense of I have to do a lot of stuff. Because other areas in our lives when we're urgent, it's like we have to accomplish something. We have to get something. I have to get my degree. I have to get my marriage. I have to get my retirement. I have to get my cremation stuff before I die. You know, there's all this stuff we have to do before we, you know, die. Right? And so we can project the same urgency of acquiring and possessions to our spiritual practice. Okay? And that's a way that the mind is kind of interpreting urgency. So the urgency is actually about coming down to this very moment. That ultimately there's nothing other to do in this moment than to release our friction with it. To release our wanting it to be something else. Even if that something else is something spiritual. Even if it is to have a spiritual experience, a mind state, enlightenment, whatever we have a sense of what that is. That's all projected out. That's all fighting with what's going on in this moment. So it comes down to this very moment. How am I relating to experience? So that's what I hope to use for the sense of urgency is not acquiring or doing more and more, because that sense of wanting to do more is it won't work out.
Right.
But you may need to explore that. You may need to say, okay, you know, I got this. I got to do more. I got to go on retreats. I've got to meditate, you know, 2 hours a day. You know, there's a sense of, and then eventually, some of us need to see that, and then. This is what he means by releasing. It's not obtaining something, not doing a lot of things so I can order, I can release, but right in this moment. Does that address your question?
Yes, thanks.
Good, thank you.